Sunday School is a production of the Olam Institute, which aims to nurture constructive approaches to religion and religious education. If you find this podcast helpful, please go to mormonsundayschool.org to sign up for a monthly subscription or to make a single donation. As the Olam Institute is a 501c3 nonprofit, all contributions are fully tax deductible. We also welcome you to join the conversation on Facebook or email me at jared@olaminstitute.org. Welcome back to Sunday School, everyone. I am Jared Anderson, and this is Engaging Gospel Doctrine, episode 208, which covers lesson 34, Helaman 6 through 10, How Could You Have Forgotten Your God? Once again, we are reissuing this completely, which gives us a really comfortable buffer that I'm excited about. We should be several weeks ahead of all schedules. That gives me time to focus on other things, including the Youth Sunday School lessons. Hopefully by the time everyone catches up with this lesson, I will have figured out where to get feedback from youth, because that is very important to this project. That is what I'm waiting for. Hopefully I can track down a Facebook group or something where I can solicit questions and comments from active youth, because I think that's vital for these episodes. If by chance I ever fall behind, you can go to mormonsundayschool.org and the tab to the right of the home tab says full episode list. And if you click on that, you can find all 4 years of our episodes and look at the lesson that you need, and it will be right there. I probably won't be putting out any more core episodes for a while until I have worked through the Youth Sunday School lessons and then the gospel doctrine topics. And then by then I'll probably just move high gear into the home evening podcast. I hope to start that in January. So lots to look forward to. Thank you so much for your support. And here is once again, lesson 34.
The focus as I'm going to approach it will be a bit different. The goal of this class is that class members will gain an increased motivation to fight negative influences in their lives, as well as also gaining a nuanced perspective on the role of both God and Satan in the scriptures, and finally ponder the nature of human character. These are intense chapters, and two prophets, both Nephi and Mormon, go off about Nephi wickedness. There are powerful lessons to be learned as well, however, about how to respond to negative influences in our lives. And also we gain an insight into Nephi's experience that gives us a window into his greatness of soul. So the overview isn't too complicated. In Helaman chapter 6, verses 1 to 14, we learn about how the Lamanites' righteousness leads to both the Lamanites and the Nephites prospering. And then that doesn't last long. In verses 15 to 41, the Gadianton robbers reappear, and Nephites and Lamanites respond differently. Mormon gives a commentary on the devil. And then in chapter 7, we have Nephi's distress and his preaching. In chapter 8 and 9, Nephi and the Gadianton judges go head to head. They argue back and forth. Nephi predicts an assassination. In chapter 10, Nephi receives the sealing power. In chapter 11, Nephi sends and then stops the famine. First it helps, and then it doesn't. And finally, we conclude with Mormon's lament concerning human nature. The first main point we're going to examine is in chapter 6, where the Lamanites become very righteous, and when the Gadianton robbers reappear, how both of them respond. In chapter 6, verse 1, we read that the Lamanites had become, the more part of them, a righteous people, insomuch that their righteousness did exceed that of the Nephites because of their firmness and their steadiness in the faith. For behold, there were many of the Nephites who had become hardened and impenitent and grossly wicked, insomuch that they did reject the word of God and all the preaching and prophesying which had come among them. Nevertheless, the people of the church did have great joy because of the conversion of the Lamanites, yea, because of the church of God, which had been established among them. And they did fellowship one with another, and did rejoice one with another, and did have great joy. The Book of Mormon rejects simple good guy, bad guy distinctions in a productive way. And I think too often readers of the Book of Mormon gloss over this, and we take it for granted, and we pigeonhole different characters into, oh yeah, this is a good guy, this is a bad guy. But there's so much more that we can learn and gain from this. Another lesson to draw from this portion is how church membership and the gospel transcends national and cultural boundaries. And I really love how the people of the church, it's not Nephites or Lamanites, it's just the people of the church. And remember, in the Book of Mormon, people of the church are those whose hearts are truly changed by the gospel. The people of the church are rejoicing and they fellowship with the new converts. And again, I think we can learn a lot from this. One of the great benefits of the LDS Church is how we do not choose who is in our wards, and we are called to be brothers and sisters with people that we may not necessarily choose to hang out with. When I was teaching the 16 and 17 year olds in Sunday school, I asked a hard question where I said, now, if you had to pick your siblings, would your brothers and sisters necessarily make the cut? And one of the girls in the class said, that's an awful question. But this is also one of the beautiful parts of the gospel, is the idea that we are a family. We are all a family, and we are called to take care of each other. And this passage in the Book of Mormon illustrates that point. The result of this conversion and the righteousness of the Lamanites is that there's peace. And because of the peace, there's an economic consequence where both the Nephites and the Lamanites become extremely wealthy, and they lived very comfortably because there was cooperation, not competition. And this cooperation equals prosperity seems very much like a true principle. This is a golden period. In verses 12 and 13, it says, they did raise grain in abundance, both in the north and in the south, and they did flourish exceedingly, both in the north and in the south. And they did multiply and wax exceedingly strong in the land, and they did raise many flocks and herds, yea, many fatlings. Behold, their women did toil and spin, and did make all manner of cloth, of fine twined linen and cloth of every kind, to clothe their nakedness. And thus the 64th year did pass away in peace. Look at the emphasis and repetition about both the north, both the south, both the Nephites, both Lamanites. And so this is it's a short, but a golden age. And remember, this comes from cooperation. And this is another key principle in the gospel, that of unity and cooperation and Zion, and transcending all those things that divide us so that we all can be better off, both spiritually and physically. Unfortunately, this golden period does not last, and the Gadianton robbers reappear. Cezorim is murdered as he sat on the judgment seat. I'm wondering what is up with assassinations right on the judgment seat. What kind of method is this where they kill people right in public? Anyway, and then his son, who is appointed, is also murdered, and people become wicked. Here is a theme in the Book of Mormon that we come across. And I'm wondering how much of Mormon's bias we're seeing. Mormon says, the Lord had blessed them so long with the riches of the world that they had not been stirred up to anger, to wars, nor to bloodshed. Therefore, they began to set their hearts upon their riches. Yea, they began to seek gain, that they might be lifted up one above another. Therefore, they might begin to commit secret murders, to rob and plunder, that they might get gain. Now, note the repetition where it says to get gain, to get gain, to get gain. And so the Book of Mormon very clearly teaches that this idea of trying to make ourselves wealthy at the cost of someone else is very problematic. But what gets my attention in this verse is where Mormon says they hadn't been stirred up to anger, wars, bloodshed. It's like, what? There are other ways to remember God. Yes, it is true that when our lives are difficult, when we reach out to God. This makes me think of Doctrine and Covenants 101, verse 8. In the days of their peace, they esteemed lightly my counsel, but in the day of their trouble, of necessity, they feel after me. So yes, there is some truth to this. Any missionary can tell you, and most anyone, we've seen this experience where when things are going well, it's easy to forget all those that we need, both in this life and God. And when we are in real hardship, we reach out to others as well as our heavenly parents. But again, it's like, it doesn't need to be war. It doesn't need to be bloodshed. And so I wonder whether, because that is all Mormon has an experience with, because for Mormons people, it is only war. It is only bloodshed. It is only the constant threat of destruction that gets any effect. Again, I wonder if Mormons' perspective is influencing this. It is very interesting to see how both the Lamanites and Nephites respond to the rise of the Gadianton robbers. And this is one of the main lessons, one of the main take-home lessons that I want everyone to pay attention to. Interestingly, the Gadianton robbers, we learn in verse 18, are more numerous among the more wicked part of the Lamanites. And so even though the problem was greater to start with among the Lamanites, we're going to see what happens. In verse 20, we read, "And now it came to pass that when the Lamanites found that there were robbers among them, they were exceedingly sorrowful, and they did use every means in their power to destroy them off the face of the earth." In 21, "But behold, Satan did stir up the hearts of the more part of the Nephites, insomuch that they did unite with those bands of robbers, and did enter into their covenants and their oaths, that they would protect and preserve one another in whatsoever difficult circumstances they should be placed, that they should not suffer for their murders and their plunderings and their stealings." So here are a couple key lessons, and I think this is very much applicable in our lives, is that when we see things that are unhealthy, that are destructive to well-being, are we sorrowful? Do we try to destroy it? And I'm not talking about judging others and not hanging out with people that we need to, but behavior and ways of living that we know are not the way we're supposed to be living, you know, being unethical. Are we sorrowful? Do we distance ourselves from it? Or do we unite to it and seek to escape consequence? I think this is deeply serious, and it is a sign of unethical living that we try to escape the natural consequences of our actions. Part of actualized mature living is when we are at peace and we fully accept the consequences of our actions. That's maturity, not saying, I want to do what I want to do and get away with it and not suffer the consequences. If we pick up one side of the stick, we need to pick up the other side. I think I mentioned before that I had a family home evening on consequences where I told my kids, I said, okay, I want you to drop this cloth in the bucket of water, but don't get it wet. And they really remembered that and liked it. And it is the natural and social consequences that we suffer from poor behavior and poor decisions. It's one of the most important gospel principles that we have in our life to keep us making good choices. And so when we try to hide from those, we are on very shaky ground. And that's what the Nephites were doing. So once again, to sum up, the Lamanites, even though the problem was more serious, they did all that they could to destroy it, whereas the Nephites united with it. And as far as the role of Satan, we are going to get to that shortly. In verses 34 to 40, we read, "And thus we see that the Nephites did begin to dwindle in unbelief and grow in wickedness and abominations, while the Lamanites began to grow exceedingly in the knowledge of their God. Yea, they did begin to keep his statutes and commandments and to walk in truth and uprightness before him. And thus we see that the Spirit of the Lord began to withdraw from the Nephites because of the wickedness and hardness of their hearts. And thus we see that the Lord began to pour out his Spirit upon the Lamanites because of their easiness and willingness to believe in his words." There's parallelism here. Dwindle, grow, Spirit withdraw, Spirit pour out. In 37 to 40, "And it came to pass that the Lamanites did hunt the band of robbers of Gadianton, and they did preach the word of God among the more wicked part of them, insomuch that this band of robbers was utterly destroyed from among the Lamanites." I wonder how that missionary work went. "And it came to pass, on the other hand, that the Nephites did build them up and support them, beginning at the more wicked part of them, until they had overspread all the land of the Nephites and had seduced the more part of the righteous, until they had come down to believe in their works and partake of their spoils and to join with them in their secret murders and combinations. I'll stop at 39. Here is the power of social contact and the power of social norms. And there are patterns in the way that Mormon is portraying this. And again, I think that we need to have a balanced discussion about this, because it's not like we can hide away in our church buildings and not interact with anyone who is a quote unquote bad influence. But as far as what we allow into our heart and the kinds of behaviors and what we entertain in ourselves as we forge our own nature. And it is true that the influence of those around us is extremely important. And so these are all lessons that we can draw from this section. I want to highlight momentarily, I brought it up a little bit, is the critique of not wealth per se, but wealth to get gain and to set ourselves above others and to be wealthy in a way that we ignore the needs of those around us. Where Mormon summarizes Nephi's problems with the Nephites in chapter 7, verse 4, he says, "Seeing the people in a state of such awful wickedness and those Gadian robbers filling the judgment seats, having usurped the power and authority of the land, laying aside the commandments of God and not in the least aright before him, and doing no justice unto the children of men, condemning the righteous because of the righteousness, letting the guilty and wicked go unpunished because of their money." It'd be interesting to think about modern parallels to that. But again, the emphasis is on ignoring the welfare of others. It's ignoring the welfare of others that's the problem. I think Jacob 2, 17 to 19 presents a pretty balanced summary of the Book of Mormon perspective on wealth, where it says, seek first the kingdom of God, seek first to care for those in need. As it says in Matthew 25, to feed the hungry and clothe the naked, and again, care for those in need. And then if we seek wealth, there's nothing wrong with wealth and prosperity per se. Once again, I think the message is pretty clear in the Book of Mormon that we just need to be aware that it's not at the cost of others. And this is a very complicated topic we could talk about more, but I'm just trying to highlight what the Book of Mormon says about it. The next point we're going to talk about is Satan. Mormon has an aside about Satan in chapter 6, verses 26 to 30. And it's pretty tricky because the way that Mormon talks about Satan, he ascribes a lot of power to him. He's talking about the Gadianton robbers and their resurgence. And he says in verse 26, this is Mormon, "Those secret oaths and covenants did not come forth unto Gadianton from the records which were delivered unto Helaman, but behold, they were put into the heart of Gadianton by that same being who did entice our first parents to partake of the forbidden fruit." So he's saying that these secret combination evil covenants were among the Jaredites, but Gadianton got them direct from Satan, special delivery. But look at what Mormon says about Satan. He says, Satan enticed our parents to partake of the forbidden fruit in 26. He did plot with Cain that if he would murder his brother Abel, it should not be known to the world. He did plot with Cain and his followers from that time forth. In 28, it is that same being who put it into the hearts of the people to build a tower sufficiently high that they might get to heaven. And it was that same being who led on the people who came from that tower into this land, who spread the works of darkness and abominations. It is that same being, in verse 29, who put into the heart of Gadianton to still carry on the works of darkness. Behold, it is he who is the author of all sin. And behold, he doth carry on his works of darkness and secret murder, and doth hand down their plots and their oaths and their covenants and their plans of awful wickedness from generation to generation, according as he can get a hold upon the hearts of the children of men. Okay, now, 30 might be key, but until then, that is literally a hell of a lot of power that Satan has. Satan is a protagonist, well, antagonist. He is a primary character. He is doing, leading, plotting, enticing. And so is that true? Does that resonate with reality? Does Satan really have that much power? How does that connect to agency? And I think there are a couple balancing factors. 30, once again, is very important. According as he can get a hold upon the hearts of the children of men. And then 7:15-16, when Nephi is talking, I think that's very important, where Nephi says, he's talking to the people who are marveling because he's praying, "And because of my mourning and lamentation, ye have gathered yourselves together and do marvel. Ye have great need to marvel. Ye ought to marvel because ye are given away, that the devil has got so great hold upon your hearts. Yea, how could you have given way to the enticing of him who is seeking to hurl away your souls down to an everlasting misery and endless woe?" And so it seems like what we're getting in 6:30 and 7:15-16 is the idea that Satan has no power except what we give him. And I think that is a more satisfying theology in several ways. However, we can still go a little bit further. Now, this isn't necessarily something I would bring up in Sunday school. It's more something I'm responsive about. But it is very interesting to look closely at how Satan and the devil functions in the scriptures, in the Bible particularly. It will surprise many of you to learn that this idea of Satan as an independent evil agent, the tempter, the cosmic force in opposition to God, that does not show up in the Old Testament. That does not show up until the New Testament, where the idea of the devil is fully developed. The most familiar example of how Satan functions in the Old Testament is in the book of Job. Have any of you ever wondered what Satan is doing hanging out, talking with God about Job? In this story, Satan is not the devil as we are familiar with the idea. He is a member of the divine council of the Israelite pantheon, and he is kind of like the prosecuting attorney, not this evil tempter. In the Old Testament, this idea of a celestial being who is called Satan is in Numbers 22, verses 22 and 32, and that's where an angel is sent to oppose Balaam. Job 1 and 2 that we just talked about, Zechariah 3, 1 and 2, and 1 Chronicles 21, 1. In Zechariah, it says, "He showed to me the high priest Joshua standing before the angel of the Lord and standing at his right hand to accuse him." So Satan, right by an angel of the Lord, accusing the high priest. And then in 1 Chronicles 21, 1, it said, "Satan stood up against Israel and incited David to count the people of Israel." So we do get this idea of Satan kind of tempting someone in Chronicles, but chronologically, that is quite a late book. To summarize, and this is from the Anchor Bible Dictionary entry on Satan, quote, "Most of the earlier literature of the Old Testament explained evil in terms of primary cause, Yahweh or God. Later Old Testament literature, such as Chronicles, expanded on this by introducing the concept of a secondary cause in its explanation of evil, Satan," end quote. So the idea of an independent tempter agent no longer in heaven is post-Old Testament, as I said, from what we can tell from a close reading of scriptures. So once again, the idea is that in early texts, God is the source of evil, and then later Satan becomes the source of evil, and that develops into a full-fledged devil figure. Now, that's just the best we can tell from historical and scriptural evidence. What you make of that personally is up to you. So once again, that aside about Satan is not something I would necessarily bring up if I were teaching in Sunday school. But I do think in this ideal environment of virtual Sunday school, it's something we can bring up. Now to another challenging issue. Students of the scriptures notice that God seems different in different passages. And I think a superior way to approach theology is to look carefully at all of the evidence and see what we learn about God's character rather than having one particular idea and forcing the evidence into that concept. And I feel like the way that we mash all the scriptures together and say this is God is both problematic and unethical. I have an issue with the idea that God is good. That part I like. but this progression. God is good. The Bible comes directly from God with no human intervention. We don't quite believe that, but we act like it sometimes. And therefore, everything in the Bible is good. Everything in the Bible is justified. And I just don't think that's the case. In Mormonism, we have a rich tradition of this idea that God speaks to us in our language. God speaks to us according to our cultural context. God speaks to us so we can understand. And therefore, I think we are very justified in engaging with the scriptures critically. Now, granted, we are more comfortable doing that with the Bible than the Book of Mormon. But as I read Helaman 11, I wonder whether this is primitive theology or whether Mormon's perspective or Nephi's perspective or someone's perspective is influencing this, because God just does not come across very well in Helaman 11. So Nephi says, enough of this war, let's have a famine. And I do think it's interesting in verse 6 where it says, the earth was smitten that it was dry, it did not yield forth its grain, and the whole earth was smitten, even among the Lamanites as well as the Nephites, so that they were smitten, that they did perish by the thousands in the more wicked parts of the land. I wonder if we can read into this, what about the righteous? Were the righteous prepared? Did they share? I was kind of thinking, what about the stupid righteous who weren't as prepared? I wonder if they cared for each other. I wonder if, and I actually think that's a good lesson we can draw from, that the righteous survived this hardship better than the wicked, because the wicked were only looking out for themselves while the righteous were cooperating. That said, this is disturbing in 11:11, where Nephi says, now, O Lord, because of this, their humility, because the people repent because they're about to die, wilt thou turn away thine anger? Let thine anger be appeased in the destruction of those wicked men whom thou hast already destroyed. Wilt thou turn away thy anger, thy fierce anger, and cause this famine to cease in this land? What is this hunger that God has for destruction and for the murder of the wicked that this is portraying? So again, it's really tricky how God is portrayed. Although, as an aside, with resource allocation, maybe God should be killing the wicked by thousands. I don't know. But I do think that we need to critically engage with this portrayal of both God and Satan. And so that's one takeaway that I want people to have as they listen to this lesson. Two more points that I want to touch on in this lesson are, first, Nephi receiving the sealing power. And this is a very moving passage in the midst of a lot of dark content. In chapter 10, Nephi had just been vindicated by this pretty amazing and humorous story of him predicting the assassination of the chief judge and telling them how to make the murderer confess. But it doesn't really do anything. There's a division. Everyone leaves. And it says in chapter 10, verse 2, it came to pass that Nephi went his way towards his own house, pondering upon the things which the Lord had shown unto him. And it came to pass, as he was thus pondering, being much cast down because of the wickedness of the people of the Nephites, their secret works of darkness and their murderings and their plunderings and all manner of iniquities. It came to pass, as he was thus pondering in his heart, behold, a voice came unto him saying, blessed art thou, Nephi, for those things which you have done. I have seen how you have with unwearyingness declared the word. You have not sought thine own life. You have sought my will. Unwearyingness is repeated. And God makes him a promise. He gives him the sealing power in verse 7, where he says, well, first in verse 6, he says, thou art Nephi and I am God. So this is very formulaic language. I declare unto thee in the presence of mine angels. This is like a contract or covenant. You shall have power. And again, I wonder why it's so negative. He doesn't say you shall have power to bring blessings and do good things. He says you shall have power to bring famine and pestilence and destruction and blow things up. But this is the sealing power. This is related to the power that Jesus gives Peter in Matthew 16:19 and 18:18, even though the wording is bind and loose. And then the wording sealing is present in Doctrine and Covenants 132:46. What I want to focus on in this narrative is what we learn from the enlightened, spiritually mature man or woman of God from Nephi's experience. And you'll know Nephi is pondering, and he's also deeply concerned about the welfare of his fellow human beings, of his brothers and sisters. And one of my favorite scriptures about compassion and empathy and caring is Moses 7:41. And this is after Enoch says to God, "How can you weep? You know, you are perfect. You have created so much. How can you weep? How is it that your bosom is there? You know, you're this amazing creator, and yet I can hug you." And God basically says, "All I want is for you to love each other. I want my children to love each other and care for each other, but they won't. And so I weep." And Enoch gets it. And in 41, it says, "And it came to pass that the Lord spake unto Enoch and told Enoch all the doings of the children of men. Wherefore Enoch knew and looked upon their wickedness and their misery and wept and stretched forth his arms, and his heart swelled wide as eternity, and his bowels yearned, and all eternity shook." I love that. It's one of my favorite verses. And perhaps nowhere as beautifully as the story of Enos is there this progression where Enos prays for his own welfare. And once he is set, he prays for his family and the Nephites and the people close to him. And then as soon as he is comforted about those close to him, he prays even for his enemies and those in opposition to him. And I think this is a very beautiful principle that is taught in the gospel and across religions, is that the more mature we get, the more refined our soul, the broader and wider our love grows. And this is one thing that we're seeing with Nephi. And then he uses his enlightened sealing power to send a famine. But, you know, we've already talked about that. The concluding point I want to talk about, and I'm sure we'll bring this up in the discussion, is chapter 12, where Mormon goes off on human nature. And so I want us all to be thinking about, what is human nature? With Helaman, we just received a example of this mature, enlightened, loving person. And then in chapter 12, Mormon has a very, very negative view of humanity. He says in chapter 12, he calls humans false, unsteady. And in verse 2, he says, "We may see at the very time when God doth prosper his people, that in that very moment, doing all things for the welfare and happiness of his people, then is the time that they do harden their hearts and do forget the good Lord their God, and do trample under their feet the Holy One. This because of their ease, their prosperity." In verse 4, "Humans are foolish and vain and evil and devilish and quick to do iniquity and slow to do good. How quick to hearken to the words of the evil one and to set their hearts upon the vain things of the world. How quick to be lifted up in pride. How quick to boast. How slow to remember God. How slow to walk in wisdom's path." In verse 6, "They do not desire the Lord their God who hath created them should rule and reign over them. They will not that he should be their guide." In verse 7, "How great is the nothingness of the children of men. They are less than the dust of the earth." This is very poetic, where he says, "For behold, the dust of the earth moveth hither and thither according to the command of God." This makes me think of the creation account in Abraham, where the more complex the creation, the longer the gods need to wait to be obeyed. So they command the elements, they command the dust, and they are obeyed. They command the animals, they see they will be obeyed. And then they create humans, and it says, "We will see if they will be faithful." So yeah, what do we do about this extremely negative view of human nature? Is this Mormon being depressed according to context? Now, granted, it is true that the history of humanity is kind of a screwing over each other and doing very, very bad things to each other. At the same time, we have the roots of altruism. And so that will definitely be a point of discussion. Those are the main points I wanted to cover. There are other comments or discussion starters I could bring up. For example, there are questions raised in Helaman 7, 16 to 23. Theologically, this is very strong about the foreknowledge of Jesus, but historically, it's challenging. Most strikingly, this mention of Esaias, E-Z-I-A-S. When I heard it, I thought this is merely the Greek form of Isaiah, and then Isaiah is mentioned right after. So I didn't find Esaias, so maybe I thought I was mistaken, but not necessarily. In the King James Version, E-S-A-I-A-S. This form is 21 times in the New Testament. So perhaps it's a coincidence, but this is a parallel issue with Elias and Elijah in Doctrine and Covenants 1:10, 12 to 13. Elias is the Greek name for Elijah in the New Testament. Somewhat jokingly, I've thought that maybe Elijah just dressed up in a toga when he gave the keys as Elias. There's an interesting point about Mulek. Mulek is not otherwise known. Orson Scott Card has a really intriguing thesis that the Mulekites were actually not descendants of Zarahemla. They were just trying to one-up the Nephites who were usurping authority. So I have a quote about that we could cover. In chapter 10, 16 to 17, I was always amused by this because it kind of sounds like teleportation, where Nephi is conveyed from one multitude to the other. 12, 14 to 15 is quite striking. It presupposes the historicity of the Jericho miracle and the sun stopping, and it tries to make it better by suggesting that the earth stops. And, you know, this could just be Mormons musing, which is fine. And so those are a couple discussion points. But once again, to conclude, I hope you take away from this lesson that we can learn from the Lamanites to sorrow and distance ourselves from destructive behaviors and patterns and seek the transformation of our souls by cleaving to what is good, not entertaining wickedness. Psychologists have talked about cycles of virtue and vice, where good behavior leads to greater ability to do good, greater joy, and the opposite also holds true. These principles fit right into the gospel context. These chapters confirm the importance of relying on a careful study and spiritual confirmation as they problematize the portrayal of both God and Satan. Finally, there are powerful lessons about unity and caring for each other and becoming the kind of person who seeks not only self-aggrandizement and prosperity, but the well-being of all God's children.
So lots of big topics to hit on: the nature of God, the nature of Satan, and the nature of human beings. I don't know what else there is to talk about in life. I am really glad to have with me this episode Matt, Aaron, Amanda, who joined us last minute, which I very much appreciate, and Jessica. For the listeners to get familiar with your voice, could you each introduce yourselves quickly, repeat your name, where you're calling from, and what is keeping you busy with life right now?
My name's Matthew Knuckleby. I live in Houston, Texas. I am currently a PhD candidate at Rice University, and I am doing my degree in electrical engineering, finishing up very shortly, at which point we will be leaving the Lone Star State.
I'm Aaron Shore. I'm calling from Orange County, California. I am a jury consultant at a law firm in Los Angeles, and I've got a wife and four young kids, and I'm a relatively new convert. I'm about 3 years in.
Yeah, we are really glad to have you.
I'm Amanda Knuckleby. I am married to Matt, which is one of the reasons why I jumped in at the last minute. I was here anyways. And like Matt said, we are in Houston, and I'm an administrative assistant at Rice University, and glad to be here.
I'm Jessica Finnegan. I live in Cambridge, England. I'm finishing up a master's in educational psychology and doing prerequisites for graduate school in international development.
Very cool. And you can tell the listeners what time it is.
5 a.m.
So 5 a.m. Thank you. You are amazing for being here. Well, let's jump right into our conversation. Matt, why don't you start us off?
Where I want to start is a discussion about Satan. I have to confess that throughout my Mormon existence, I've always been a little bit at odds with the way that we usually talk about Satan within Mormonism. So I want to go Helaman chapter 6, verse 30, where it said that Satan is the author of all sin. Now, this is after he's gone on a tirade for a while, talking about how Satan has inspired the Gadianton robbers to bring back those oaths and covenants. The problem that I have with this is where agency is in Satan being responsible for all sin. We usually talk about this in terms of opposition in all things, that if it weren't for Satan, no one would sin. And then we have the light of Christ on the other side, and we have to be tempted by one side or the other. And that's never really worked for me, because I feel like if Satan is the only reason that we sin, that is, if it weren't for Satan, we wouldn't sin, it's hard to hold man accountable for those sins. For example, Satan tempts us extra hard, and so we're more likely to sin. It seems like that'd be a mitigating factor that God would take into account when he judges us for our sins. So the only way that I've been able to make sense out of sin within a Mormon context is that we're capable of sin with or without the presence of Satan. We can sin independent of the existence of Satan. And maybe Satan's doing his own thing, trying to tempt us. And really, in the grand scheme of things, that's not really having any effect on anybody's salvation, because we're capable of doing evil things all on our own.
Yeah, other thoughts that people wanted to share?
You know, I totally agree with Matt. This is Aaron. Because, you know, coming to this concept of an evil actor and being who is a counterbalance to the hand of God in our life is something that, you know, not only I wonder about, but also makes me wonder about the nature of our responsibility. If he's the one tempting us extra hard, as Matt said, but the way I tended to look at that is more in the context of the preexistence. That is, in the preexistence, we were all spirit children of Heavenly Father, and the eldest spirit child is Christ. And we have some of Christ's, for lack of a better term, genes within us, which I tend to look at as the light of Christ, that that's part of who we are, is that Christ-like nature that we gained as being part of that spirit family in the preexistence. And the corollary to that is we have part of the genes of Satan as the sort of counterpart to Christ as our older brother. And that that is what goes on within us when we're tempted, that it's our inclination to sin, just as we have an inclination to love or to do good or to open our hearts to one another. And agency occurs in that intersection between those two innate tendencies that we have. And for me, that makes a lot more sense in terms of how Satan acts in our lives, because it's Satan's influence that's already pre-built within us that we're carrying around from us in our souls since birth.
That feels like a really productive way to look at it. And one of my favorite parts of Mormonism is how much it puts agency at the center of everything, you know? And what, you know, there are debates about free will and determinism and what is the role. And in some theologies of Christianity, it's almost like humans are pawns in this game, you know, like a chess game between God and the devil. And that doesn't seem satisfying. And so I think Mormon theology is so much more satisfying. And kind of building on what both of you said, it's kind of like we have within us those elements, and God kind of represents the actualization and the fullness of those divine elements, and Satan represents the actualization and fullness of the others. And so we have these examples, and yes, they influence us, but they are really just elements within us. And that feels productive to me. So basically, what I think we need to do is cautiously question and problematize Mormon's phraseology of Satan is the author of all sin, because I don't think it washes with Mormon theology, logic, agency, and life.
I like to think of Satan as sort of an ancillary part of the theology. He happened to rebel in the premortal existence. It's here. But if he weren't here, we still have good and evil within us. I think this speaks very well to the theology of humans becoming like God. If we have intrinsically within us the potential to become divine, similarly, we have within us the potential to become diabolical, or at least to do diabolical things. And so whether or not there actually happened to have been an actual Satan character who was able to stand as the embodiment of that, I think is beside the point.
I think it works either way, which is a productive way as far as like not knowing exactly the contours of reality. I just changed up our plan a little bit. I think we might as well just jump into human nature, right? We're talking, because we're already talking about it. We're already talking about how we have Satan, we have God, and we have us in between. And so what does that mean about us? And one thing, I do feel like these chapters give us a nuancing in the text itself. As I said during the lesson where Nephi tells the people in his rant, you have opened yourself to that influence, you have let him in. So as you said, Matt, kind of however literally we take these things, it is really just opening ourselves and entertaining either the more devilish or divine aspects of our human nature. So with that segue, why don't we jump right into this huge question of what is human nature? And this is, of course, going off of Mormon's total venting in Helaman 12, where he goes off and says that humans are frail and awful. And, you know, Matt wanted me to say this, that God just wants to give us lollipops and all we do is shoot each other. So I want to hear all of your thoughts on it. So what are we, what is our nature as human beings?
Well, I guess my initial reaction is if he didn't give us lollipops, maybe we wouldn't be shooting each other because there wouldn't be anything to fight over. Maybe that's the question, is what are the desires of our hearts? And so we have, you know, these good things which we innately desire in our lives, and we have suffering and pain which we innately reject. And so that sort of preset pattern of what we seek or what we reject in our lives is what puts us in conflict with these other people. And I guess, you know, in terms of human nature, one of the things that really resonated with me from your lesson was an explanation of the sort of motives of the Gadianton robbers. What, you know, not only their temporal motives, but, you know, why is it that they were tempted that way? And I never really understood what the Gadianton robbers really represented or what the analogy to our day is. But you said something that really resonated with me, which is that the discussion of this secret combination tendency that was put in their hearts by Satan is essentially the desire to not be caught for their murders or their robberies or all of the bad stuff that they do. It's essentially not being responsible for what it is that they are doing. And if we're not responsible for what it is that we're doing, that's the denial of agency, which goes again back to this sort of the main goal of Satan, which is the denial of agency, the ability for human beings to choose is what is so threatening to him. So for me, the Gadianton robbers are the embodiment of essentially Satan's plan in the pre-existence and what it is that he seeks to accomplish on Earth, because it's their seeking to avoid responsibility for all it is that they have. So, you know, they want their lollipops, but they don't want to have to go to the dentist.
Yeah, that does mesh quite well with 2 Nephi 2, where it talks about if there's no punishment, if there's no law, if there's no... And fitting the pieces together in this discussion, one other point about human nature, one of my favorite concepts that I think I brought up in an earlier lesson, this is in M. Scott Peck's The Road Less Traveled, and he's talking about original sin, and he says that humans by nature are selfish and lazy. And so, like, that laziness is the avoidance of consequence, avoidance of growth. The selfishness is wanting to get what we want at the cost of others, or even if it costs others. I mean, we also have altruism within us. And then the other thing with the Gadianton robbers and how the Nephites and the Lamanites responded to the Gadianton robbers, and maybe this is something that we could hear some more comments on, is what would human nature be like in the absence of the refinements of civilization? Because is it an overstatement to say that it is society that keeps us in large, large part behaving at our best, quote unquote? It takes a pretty enlightened person to make good choices independent of social disapproval and consequences and things like that.
I guess it depends on what you mean by choices. I might be about to say something that's going to get contradicted by my anthropologist wife, but it seems that pre-civilization human groups were extraordinarily cooperative and extraordinarily egalitarian by necessity. And so if you just mean working together and sharing, it seems like civilization actually enables us to go off on our own and to hoard our stuff.
Oh, can I say something really quick, Matt? I'm not talking about civilization. I'm sorry. I'm talking about society. I probably misspoke, because in the hunter-gatherer early societies you're talking about, because of the smallness, there is a tremendous amount of accountability. I would guess. So that's what I'm talking about.
Well, I was going to go off on this whole idea of hunter-gatherer societies being these egalitarian, peaceful places, and how sometimes it's actually not true if we look at modern examples.
I want to hear what you think about human nature.
As far as human nature goes, I kind of agree with you, Jared, that there is this innate kind of selfishness and laziness to humans. But at the same time, I do think there is this altruism that we have as a species. And I like this whole idea of the light of Christ. And what I like to... I do yoga, right? And at the end of your yoga practice, you say namaste. And, there's a lot of interpretations on what that word means. And the one that I always really, really like is the light in me recognizes and salutes the light in you. This idea that we all have this spark of goodness, this spark of, I want to be in my body and be a part of society and be good and do good. And we all have that, but we naturally have this desire to be territorial, to be selfish, and to be combative about what we possess, whether that be material things or philosophical things. And it's this constant kind of battle, I think, within each of us as to what, to use a religious phrase, which master to serve. I think it's a constant battle for all of us. And I think that we all have good in us. And ultimately, we try our best.
Yeah, and I think that fits quite nicely into the narrative that we're talking about, like influence of God, influence of Satan. We have all these elements.
I just like to think human nature as that we have within us, like Amanda said, like that we have within us the desire to share our light. And I think about that a lot as like levels of energy, like, and within a society, I've often thought, like, why didn't God just create the world like we have it now? Like, why has been this process of creating and making a society where it's even possible to communicate across, the Atlantic Ocean, or it's possible to communicate with people in space. But I think that in our human nature, we have this desire to organize ourselves. And I like to think about it maybe because I have kids, and like, it just seems like the world just decays into chaos, like if we're not organized enough to like battle the entropy, like. And so I think of human nature a lot like that, like we have the ability to organize ourselves, and as we work, like you said in the lesson, that as we work together and learn to love each other, that we might not necessarily pick for ourselves, that we slowly organize our ability. So instead of just radiating, lost heat into the universe, like we learn to use the light and to like share that.
Wow, that is beautiful. Thank you. Amanda, turning to you.
As I was reading chapter 7 in Helaman, I was struck by idea that Mormon and then Nephi is talking about the Nephites becoming, more wicked, and Mormon says in the space of not many years, they've become this wicked people. And in this reading that I did, I thought about how we're told that in a church, every generation, this generation is so much more wicked than the one before, and you're the chosen generation. And it seems like every generation in modern times, that's what we're told. And so I thought to myself, is Mormon and then Nephi, as he goes on his tirade about how the Nephites are so wicked, is he got a little bit of old man syndrome going on? It's very natural for humans to look at what they were taught growing up, the world that they lived in, to have this like really perfect nostalgia for it, to rewrite it in their minds and say, oh, those were such good times. And now things are just awful. If only we could go back to those times. And I saw a lot of that as I was reading chapter 7. And Nephi goes on about how if only he could live in the time of Lehi, the people were, he says, people were easy to be entreated and firm to keep the commandments. If my days could have been those days. And I thought, well, first of all, don't you remember Laman and Lemuel. And the fact that, especially right after Lehi died, it was so terrible that, you know, the Nephites had to split off from the Lamanites because they were kind of awful people. And so it's this interesting rewrite of history as he's remembering, you know, quote unquote, the good old days. And then, you know, he goes on and people are like, hey, Nephi, what are you doing on your garden tower? And he's like, get off my lawn, and starts preaching to them more. And then he goes on about, you know, he's just converted all these Lamanites and had this wonderful experience. And he says, you know, how can you not be more like the Lamanites? You know, it's this classic parental relationship of, why can't you be more like my other son or daughter? That's so much better than you. And I found that chapter really interesting with that reading, with that perspective of Nephi maybe seeing his people in this negative light because he is yearning for the nostalgia of better days, whether or not they existed in the way that he thought they did. I think that's something we can all relate to. And that's something that really struck me in this lesson.
Wow. Yeah. Nephi is humanized and very interesting. I mean, he is a human, but very, you definitely see his flaws in these chapters, but he does have teleportation power, which maybe we'll talk about. So, Jessica,
I just wanted to comment about chapter 6, verse 13, where it's talking about the women who were able to make cloth and fine twine linens. I just thought this was an interesting, going back to last week's lesson about how we don't really get a picture of what the lives of women were like in the Book of Mormon very often, because we're caught up in this war and, you know, very like Mormon's world for a lot of it. I thought this verse was interesting because I was like, well, why would this be in here? And I think one reason is it really showed how like prosperous and stable for that section of time, like that society had become. Because I think women are often, like, their suffering is often overlooked in war. And like, I bet they hadn't been able to do that for a long time, like to be that stable, to have, you know, herds and flocks and fatlings, like to even sit down and to weave is a very time intensive and requires, you know, a certain level of stability within a society.
Wow, that is a really cool window. I don't mean any disrespect, but yeah, Nephi is going to take care of them in a couple chapters. Because we can come back to some of those points if we want to bring it up as we conclude. I did want to turn to the listener comments. Elizabeth made some very poignant and perceptive comments that I'm going to read. She said, I like the connection drawn in chapter 6 between humility, fellowshipping with each other, and experiencing joy. I find that I feel more joy as I spend time celebrating the joy of others, and wish that my associations with others were characterized more by celebrating with them and less by feeling judged. Wow, I resonated with that. As I said, I think that that particular passage gives us a really, really good example for as church members, and that we could fellowship and rejoice with each other. She continues, I like the correlation between being willing to be easily persuaded to follow God and experiencing an abundance of the Spirit. She said, I wonder at the need to testify of the power of Satan, that we've talked about that at length. And here, this is for you, Amanda. She says, I find chapter 7 sort of self-indulgent, and my reading of 1 Nephi doesn't persuade me that the people at the time were easy to be entreated, firm to keep the commandments, or slow to be led to iniquity. Very pessimistic, and the notion of standing in a tower by the roadside and mourning for the wickedness of others out loud in such a way as to draw attention is very weird to me. That's a nice, sincere reflection. She continues, I'm aware that pride... I love this comment. She says, I'm aware that pride due to riches is something from which we may need to repent, but I'd really like to try wealth out and see if I can avoid the pride trap myself. Q. Tevier, would it mess up some vast eternal plan? Chapter 8, I think about corruption, about evidences people require to build faith on, how much variety there is. I wonder how closely the people held to the memory of the miracles of Moses, how much cultural weight those things had truth. And this is really funny. On a lighter note, she says, chapter 10, this is the teleportation thing. Chapter 10, I get a whack-a-mole vision of Nephi popping up to testify and then vanishing to reappear elsewhere. I guess the Gadianton robbers would be playing that game. chapter 11, this is poignant. She says, I wonder why slow starvation is better than war for motivating repentance. Is it better because the women and children die first? Yeah. I have to say, holding scriptures accountable, I found it deeply troubling, this whole theology of like, well, God needs to punish, there needs to be war, there needs to be violence, there needs to be famine. And it's thoughts that people had about that.
I had the same thoughts as I was reading that chapter for Jared. And the thoughts that came to my mind were, you know, first of all, does those chapters, as Nephi is talking to God saying, hey, why don't you spare these people the sword and give them famine? I thought, so does that mean that God causes war to happen or causes natural disasters to happen to teach his children a lesson? Have we gone into Pat Robinson territory here of blaming hurricanes on the gays? Or, you know, is that what's going on? And like, I was really disturbed by that, and really disturbed by also the fact that, you know, if, say, hypothetically, if God works this way, obviously innocent people, as the comment shared, Elizabeth shared, obviously innocent people are going to be affected by that. And so is it worth it to God to sacrifice innocent people, women and children in a famine who are going to die more quickly to teach people a lesson? That's awful.
Yeah, I was super disturbed, because one problematic aspect in these chapters is we don't get much wiggle room. It's one thing. I think it's actually, I say this carefully, it's kind of worse than Pat Robinson, because it's one thing to say, oh, that hurricane was because you're wicked, or oh, that natural disaster was because of this. These chapters, it is more deliberate and more extreme, where God is saying, okay, Nephi, you can do whatever you want, hint, hint, even make lots of people die. And I don't mean to make light, because this is very serious. These are very serious issues. And then Nephi does exactly that, where he says, you know, we've had enough war. Let's have really, really, really bad famine. You know, that caused thousands of people to die. And so this is God directly causing it, as you asked, Amanda, rather than a theology that I am more comfortable with, which is that because of our purposes in this life, we need to live in a world where we have to care for each other.
This reminds me of a discussion you had, I think, in the last podcast about the Odyssey and the nature of suffering, and suffering caused by humans to humans versus suffering caused by sort of naturalness. But for me, it seems like both of those can be tied back to God. If we get into this causation cycle of, you know, who's to blame for this, it ultimately ends up at God's feet anyway, all suffering. So there has to be sort of another, for me, I have to take another view of it. And that is, God has to take the long view, or the view out of time, or the eternal view of these things. And if you go back to Helaman 9, when he's talking about the priesthood power being bestowed upon Nephi and saying, listen, do whatever you want, because I know that you won't do anything that's beyond my will, right? So then Nephi thinks, oh, well, I need to teach these folks a lesson, so let's have them starve. And so they starve, but that doesn't work. So for me, the long view of what God's will in that cycle is that, listen, if you choose to make people suffer, that may have its effect in the short term, but it's not a long-term solution to this, that there's no sort of external, there's no external force that can make people turn from iniquity to righteousness. So for me, I think it may be unfortunate that the scriptures are demonstrating Nephi's mistake in thinking that this famine would turn these people to righteousness, and whether it worked in the short term or didn't work in the long term, that's sort of Nephi's temporal view of what must be done. But in the end, it didn't work. And so it couldn't have been God's will for them to suffer and to starve.
Wow. That's an interesting way to look at it. I mean, it seems kind of magic-y, not to put it in a disrespectful way, but it does. That is very interesting way to wrestle with the narrative.
Oh yeah, I just want to respond a little bit to that. I entirely agree that it makes sense for God to take the long view. And so there's actually a really interesting question about whether or not Nephi, who seems like he is actually asking the Lord to reduce the suffering by stopping the war and bringing in a famine, is doing the right thing in the long view, whether God is sort of compelled to listen to what Nephi is asking for because he's granted him this sealing power. But where I disagree is the idea that the suffering ultimately has to be laid at the feet of God. I actually think this is one of Mormonism's strengths theologically, by putting so much emphasis on agency, that the suffering is at least in part at the hands of the people who perpetrate it. And so these wars that are starting are at least in part due to the people who perpetrate them. And so we've been wrestling with this idea of agency the entire discussion. And I can't help but wonder, where is the agency here? Apparently these people were going to engage in war. And then at Nephi's insistence, God stops them. You know, how does he stop them? I suppose it's possible for him to stop them in a way that doesn't, you know, completely and finally impinge upon their agency. But it does seem like he is not giving them very much ability to choose their actions for themselves.
I want to ask your thoughts on something that occurred to me. It had never occurred to me until this lesson as I was preparing it. Yes, I'm totally acknowledging the disturbing aspects of this whole famine thing. But do you think it's reading too much into it to say that perhaps the righteous were caring for each other, which is why the wicked died and the righteous didn't? Where they were sharing resources, they were, maybe they had food, you know, maybe they had prepared in advance. I don't know. I don't know if that's pushing too far into the text, you know, to say that like they had food storage.
But I think it's completely logical, because the lesson that they taught in the previous chapters was that you've got to share with those that are under less privileged than you are. And that's something we haven't talked about yet, is this whole sort of the economics of righteousness.
Ooh, I like that
chapter.
Can I say one thing about the women dying?
Yeah.
So I think in famine, often women do better than men.
That's true.
Because they have more fat and they metabolize slower. But not that I know in this case, but I think that, like, you know, often women are more willing to share their resources. I mean, there's been quite a few studies that if you give women money, they spend the vast majority of it taking care of other people.
Yeah, maybe it's because of the women that this whole little thing worked. Has anyone else heard of the little story about heaven and hell and the spoons on the elbows?
Yeah, I've heard that.
No.
So super quick, it illustrates this point. I don't want to belabor the point too much, but I don't even remember the context, but it's this idea of this guy visits hell. And in hell, there's this amazing feast, like the best food that you can imagine. It's sumptuous. It's exactly what everyone wants. But everyone is miserable because they have the only way they can eat, like they can't use their hands or something, and the only way they can eat is these spoons on their elbows. So it's kind of like Sisyphus, you know, where it's just beyond their reach. They cannot feed themselves. And this person who visits hell is like, wow, yeah, this is really miserable, you know, to be so close to the object of your desire and yet you not being able to care for yourself. And so he goes and he visits heaven, and he is shocked to see that everyone has spoons on their elbows. And they can't use their hands. He's like, wait a minute, you know, what's going on here? Is this hell too? But no, everyone is feeding each other. And I think, you know, it's kind of that beautiful little simple story of we can do so much if we care for each other. And that is one lesson that I would like to draw from these chapters. And I think it's there, you know, I'm not reading too deeply into it. This, and I like what you said, Aaron, where maybe that does go together, where there's so much teaching about, you know, don't set yourself above others, care for those in need. And maybe that was how the righteous survived. So any concluding questions or comments you want to bring up?
I have something really quick, kind of going off what you just said, Jared. You know, when I read these in chapter 6, when I read about, Jeff Carity brought this up, but this idea of, you know, the Nephites being all this peace in the land, and they're tilling the land and they're growing things and they're you know, making clothes, this kind of really pastoral depiction of life. And I thought, you know, it says that the Nephites are rich. And I read that this time as they're rich in the sense that they are experiencing peace. Maybe not necessarily from being super righteous, but there's no wars going on. And they're more focused on, as you said, they're more focused on taking care of each other. They're more focused on the simple joys in life. And that is how they are rich, not in necessarily how much money they have, but in the fact that they are enjoying a very simple, but very worthy and powerful life of living and taking care of each other. And that was something that really struck me.
And what's interesting about the notion of being rich when it talks about how they're in communion with each other and the Nephites and the Lamanites can buy and sell and then they succeed is that that richness is not indolence. They're not, you know, billionaires that don't have to lift a finger, don't have to work or do anything. They're industrious and rich. And I think there's a lesson there as well, that wealth is tied to industry. It's one thing to be rich and another thing to sort of be wealthy. And I think you're describing wealth far more than you are riches.
Yeah, I like that. That makes me think of 2 Nephi 5, where it says they lived after the manner of happiness. They worked hard. They built. Again, good lessons that we can draw from there. Correct me if I'm wrong. Isn't it cooperation that is the crowning achievement of our species? Because if I recall, the Neanderthals, like, we used to think our tools were better, but no, like theirs was. They were stronger. They had bigger brains. They had better tools. Maybe they didn't have language. That's debated as far as I understand. But we cooperate. Like, we work together. And that has made all the difference. And hopefully, it can also get us out of messes we're getting ourselves in. Because we're not cooperating enough.
No, I agree. Like, I think that, you know, really within cooperation lies, like, many of the answers to, you know, the problems that we face. And that's one thing that I see. Like, I don't, that's one thing that I try to explain to my children, that, like, you don't know who has the answer to your problem. So try, you know, to figure that out. Like, try to work with everybody.
And isn't cooperation another way to be as one?
Oneness and Zion and all those principles, I think that's a good note to end on. Lots of territory covered here. Matt, Amanda, Aaron, and Jessica, thank you so much for your time. Jessica, thank you for talking to us at 5 a.m. We appreciate it. Want to thank our listeners. I was just looking at my Facebook stats, and there has been a weekly total reach of plus 1,600%. So people are talking about this. I think it's reaching people, it's helping people, and I really appreciate that. So please continue to share this if you find it's useful. Tell your families about it. I have been very touched by how many people are instantly using it in lessons, and I feel like we're doing a lot of good. If you are able to donate, please do that. That is extremely helpful.